All right, I think we'll go ahead and get started here. Some people trickle in. My name's Ken Hill. I am the Brokers, Asset Managers, Exchanges Analyst at Barclays. Today I'm pleased to welcome E-Trade Financial to our conference here. Actually, their first time here, and Mr. Mike Pizzi is going to be presenting. Mike's been with E-Trade since 2003, held a variety of roles from Chief Risk Officer, Treasurer, and currently CFO. So, from our perspective, we see E-Trade as one of the more interesting stories within the e-broker space. It's got a lot of capital flexibility. It's an interesting time out there for customers in the market. So we're looking forward to hearing some of Mike's thoughts on, you know, how you're navigating the current rate environment, the overall stock market levels, and how you're thinking about capital deployment longer term. So with that, I will turn it over. Thanks.
Thank you, Ken. It's nice to be here, and this is our first time presenting at this conference. I'll start with a safe harbor statement. I will be making a reference to some non-GAAP metrics, as well as making some forward-looking statements. So for a full reconciliation, please consult our financials filed with the SEC, which are available on our webpage. E-Trade is optimally positioned to deliver long-term value to shareholders. Over the past several years, we have transformed our earnings profile. We have realigned our business profile for success, and we have put in place a structure for the optimal generation, utilization, and deployment of capital. I can firmly say that this is a good time to be an E-Trade shareholder, and I think the execution over the past number of years is a testament to that. I've been with the company a little over a decade, and in that time I can say that this is one of the strongest positions that we've ever been in from a value creation standpoint. The future is moving in our direction. Digital adoption rates across the industry continue to rise from the youngest investor to those investors in retirement. In our industry, we believe that the value proposition provided by the direct space, those us and our closest competitors within the digital space, has generated about a 5% increase in growth since 2008 versus the traditional model or the traditional wirehouse. We believe that digitally assisted financial services, a hybrid model of digital that's combined with the human element, is the right business model for success in today's financial services environment. Now, digital has been in our DNA, and you'll notice through this timeline and evolution of our history, from the first online trade executed by Bill Porter over 30 years ago to multiple firsts, firsts in two-factor authentication, in security, in mobile, now in wearables, and really the first also in a software launch of a professional trading platform. We seek to build on this history of innovation to drive innovation in our platform forward, and that's what you're going to continue to see from E-Trade. We have simplified our key business objectives. Now, to accelerate growth in the core brokerage business and to generate robust earnings growth and healthy returns on capital. Now, when we look at the upper and lower half of this slide, you'll note several points of competitive differentiation. But at this point in the presentation, I want to cover two of those points that I will come back to in some detail later in the presentation. On the upper half of the presentation, many are surprised to learn that we are the largest provider in stock plan administration. That's employees when paid in company stock or equity. We are the largest administrator in that space. This is a valuable feeder channel of account growth to us, and we're going to touch on just how valuable that is a little bit later in the deck. In the bottom half, where we talk about our structure a bit, we are fully able to monetize the value of cash brought to us by our customers through our bank via sweep deposits. We believe this is an important element of competitive differentiation and an important element in our structure overall. Okay, the next slide, slide six, focuses really on the combination of our digital hybrid platform, of the digital elements of our platform when combined with the human elements of our platform. You'll see there the first, eTrade.com. That's our award-winning website. eTrade Mobile, which is really more than just one application. It is a variety and suite of applications across all sorts of tablets, now down even to wearables. And eTrade Pro, which is our professionally installed software for highly active professional traders. Today's investors expect a seamless platform no matter what element of our platform they're on. They consider it one product. We aim to provide that seamless platform with a range of tools for them, from the most novice to the professional, to support their trading and investing needs. When human guidance is necessary, you'll see towards the bottom of the slide that we have 275 financial consultants, 24/7 round-the-clock customer support, specialized customer service for elite and professional-level traders, and for when face-to-face interaction is necessary, 30 branches across the United States. Now, while we're smaller on the human side than some of our competitors, we feel that a digitally centric model supported by light touch human interaction is the right approach to financial services. So let's start with the mainstay of our business, trading. In trading, we believe it's supported by a full suite of products. So equities, options, ETFs, bonds, derivatives, futures. It's also supported by the seamless trading experience across platform. And I was touching that before when I described each of our platforms. We support that trading with guidance, a variety of tools that we make available at no charge or cost to all our customers, optimizers, tools, screeners, that we provide as part of the product. A good example of this is our recent margin analyzer. When we looked at really sophisticated margin users who had complex option pair positions and detailed amounts of underlying margin securities, we found that the computation of margin requirements became quite murky. Well, we provided a simple, easy-to-use margin calculator that allows customers to dissect and analyze their changes in margin requirements with incremental positions and market movements, giving clarity to a very murky calculation. We also understand that customers expect flexibility around their money when they want to move cash, when they want to pay a bill. So what we've incorporated into every eTrade account is full cash management functionality. So that is your bill pay, so online bill pay, online mobile pay, and now even Apple Pay, giving customers complete freedom to make payments, make transfers, and move money throughout their account. How do we define sort of how we're doing here, and how do we look at sort of key metrics? Well, the key metric is daily average revenue trade in trading, or we refer to as DARTs when you listen to our conference calls. Well, we're off to a pretty good start in Q1 at $165,000, up from full year pace last year of $155,000. And a couple important components of DARTs. One, 16% of DARTs were executed through mobile platforms. That continually goes up about a percent or two each quarter. And it again gets back to a point of seamless execution across platform. Customers, whether on their mobile and then on their desktop, expect the feel and seamlessness of the product to be there. About 25% or 23% of those DARTs, around a quarter roughly, are coming through derivatives. Now, equally important to our business is our margin book. If you look down on the bottom right of the chart there, we are at $6.3 billion in margin receivables. And it's important to note that while margin is a very profitable for us and it's one of the highest spread assets on our balance sheet, it is a barometer of customer risk appetite. And so unsurprisingly, given the high amounts of volatility that we experienced in the first quarter, that the margin balance would come down from period end to $6.3 billion. That volatility is just causing customers to pull back on their risk. Margin is a leverage product and to delever a bit through a very volatile period. Another important driver of the revenue picture is cash growth. And I'm going to talk a little bit later about how we monetize the value of cash in our platform. During the first quarter, we grew cash to $43 billion, up from $42 billion, and consistent growth in customer cash has allowed us to grow our balance sheet, which we've announced we're going to grow to our target state of 49.5, all of which I'm going to touch on a little bit later in the presentation. But now I want to move to an area that we see a great potential for growth, and it's an area that we're known for a bit less, and that's the retirement investment and savings area. We believe that growing in retirement begins really with education, and that's putting out a lot of educational resources and materials, from live on-demand seminars delivered over the web to in-branch seminars that are done in person around our 30 branches and financial centers. We believe in empowering self-directed investors with a variety of tools, calculators, screeners, and portfolio tools to help them build the best portfolio. From a guidance perspective, when a customer wants to talk to an FC, we have 275 FCs that are ready to help a customer, from helping them design that portfolio to a managed investment product, all the way to a UMA account, which would be a fully managed, full-service account. And we believe that we provide a very good value proposition overall in this space. Why do we think it's such an area of growth? Well, let's look to the next slide. With $285 billion of customer assets, about $50 billion of them are in retirement. Of that $285 billion of customer assets, we only have about a 10 to 12% wallet share. We view this as a source of opportunity. We have a lot of customers with a small fraction of their overall wallet share with us. We believe the assets that they're holding elsewhere are mainly, or a mainstay of them, is in retirement assets. We think that by raising awareness of product and capability, and certainly putting in front of them the better value proposition that we offer, we will be able to meaningfully improve that wallet share statistic over time. You can see that in some of the fee-generating asset growth that we've had. We are new to the game of fee-generating assets, launching managed products not that long ago. And you can see that we've had pretty good growth overall through 2015. Well, we've talked a bit about how we're going to raise awareness. So how exactly are we going to do that? Well, we have one of the most recognizable brands in financial services and one of the most consumer-friendly brands as well. That's been grown over time through the development of our advertising. While we're not going to change that, we are going to shift our messaging to more focus on the capabilities of the product within our advertising. So in our national media advertising, we are going to be focusing more and more on getting a message around capabilities and value that we bring to investors and traders. In addition to that, we believe we have found the right mix of digital marketing with traditional media marketing, and that is using various approaches to place our product offering in front of a prospect customer when that customer is looking for that type of product online. We think that we've shifted that mix a bit over a number of years. We think we've found the right mix between traditional media and digital advertising to continue to foster growth over time. So let's talk a little bit about growth and where we've been now that we've covered the two large elements of our business. Firstly, growth in assets, and secondly, growth in accounts. We're off to a very good start. With Q1 coming in at $2.9 billion in net new assets and 45,000 net new accounts, growing almost 50% of last year's full-year pace in the first quarter alone. Equally as important to how well we are growing is how well we are keeping customers. In the first quarter, we had attrition of 7.3%, a very low and very good overall result. Now, more important, though, than just where the first quarter came in, is looking back over the prior 4 years, we've been able to execute to an attrition level at 9% or below. Given that our stock plan business is running through the attrition total, we believe this is a very good overall result. Keep in mind, we are a macro-sensitive business, and net new assets and net new accounts will fluctuate meaningfully with the market environment and the macro environment that we were in. But a consistent growth of our accounts cross-cycle leads the next high to be a higher high, and that's what we continue to focus on, the execution of growth outside of the market environment that we find ourselves in. Okay, I talked a little bit early about the other point of competitive differentiation. This is our stock plan business. Our Equity Edge online platform in stock plan administration is the leading software platform for stock plan administrators. It has the number one customer satisfaction and has been recognized by Group 5 in terms of its overall capabilities. We currently operate about administer stock plans for about 1,000 corporate clients and 20% of the S&P 500. So we have some very big name companies that we administer stock plans for. We focused on a service model here that really differentiates us in this space. We focus on servicing the stock plan administrator, the software user. We focus on servicing the participant, making sure they understand the structure of their equity holdings within the stock plan account. And we focus on the executive of the plan company because they have special needs that are different from other participants. How have we done here? Well, we have done quite well. We've grown from little over 1 million accounts in 2011 to 1.4 million accounts today. And the important thing about this from a feeder channel of growth is when you look at that bottom panel, we have $97 billion of total stock plan assets, $66 billion of which are unvested. That $66 billion will come through us as those executions occur. Now, we're doing okay here. We have about 15% of what gets executed is retained with us 12 months after execution. So this is currently a very live and very active feeder channel for our business. But we think we can do better. By putting specially trained FCs on campuses, by redefining our content and education materials and bringing them to our plan customers, we think that over time, we should be able to meaningfully penetrate these assets as they move through us. I'm going to shift a little bit to our balance sheet. And this slide shows the composition of our balance sheet overall. And it's the first slide that really touches on how we monetize cash within our model. On the right-hand panel, you can see that the cash in the liabilities. Our balance sheet is almost entirely funded by customer cash, which we're paying about a 2 basis point rate on. On the left-hand panel, you can see that our investments outside of our core margin book are largely going to be agency and agency-backed government securities, earning a yield of about 254 basis points. Cash growth is key in terms of growing our overall revenue base. You also see that our legacy loan portfolio continues to decline, and although it's generating a nice overall yield and spread at 423 basis points, it continues to run down over time. On the liability side, as many well know, we took out our expensive legacy liabilities last year, and so you can see that these charts are becoming increasingly dominated by our core business. From a net interest margin perspective, margin in Q1 came in at 281 basis points on average interest earning assets of $40.9 billion, up significantly from 2015. Keep in mind that part of the transformation of our earnings power that we talked about earlier came in 2015 through the elimination of that expensive wholesale funding, that 329 basis point funding that's in the orange in the slide below. We also have the first full quarter of the Fed increase that occurred late in December, both of us driving the net interest margin. We also benefited handsomely from very, very low prepayment speeds on our securities holdings. So I touched on the legacy loan portfolio a little bit in that slide, and I wanted to provide a little bit more detail on it here. The portfolio is down to about $4.7 billion. We saw an acceleration of the overall runoff rate last year, declining from $6.4 billion to about $5 billion. That remains intact and paying off an additional $300 million over the first quarter. We look at the other panel. The large increase in quality of the portfolio that occurred from 2011 through to 2015 has been maintained and really continues, but albeit at a slower rate in today's environment. So the loan portfolio is getting smaller at an accelerated rate, and we are maintaining our overall improvement in quality that we saw in the portfolio in a number of years leading up to 2015. If we look at the bottom half, this is really the risk that many in the market have been concerned about. This is the conversion risk of loans from interest only to amortizing. When that occurs, there is a payment shock. The borrower's payment increases as the loans begin to amortize. We believe this generated credit risk within the portfolio, and we've taken pains to dissect especially the home equity portion of these conversions, taking the high-risk loans and providing a full life of loan allowance against them, taking the non-high-risk loans and extending the emergence period to 18 months, taking all appropriate qualitative factors into account, and I'm very happy to say that to date, through 50% of the conversions, we are performing at or better than expectation. With a little bit of more than 50% left to go, we believe this problem is now firmly in the rearview mirror. Slide 17 is really a timeline of our capital plan. And while the checkbox approach makes it seem like much of this was easy to do, I can assure you that it was not, and it's really what I've spent the last 5 years really focused on at the company. It began in 2012 when we filed our capital plan with the Federal Reserve and the OCC, and began really with a process of delevering our balance sheet to begin moving capital up to the parent company. That capital at first used to service debt, then to pay down debt, and to drive our debt costs significantly lower than they were, ultimately opening us up to a place where we can begin share repurchases, which we began in earnest in the fourth quarter, and we completed $301 million of during the first quarter of this year. So a clear track record of success. And in the next few slides, I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the big things we did here and a little bit about where we're going in the evolution of the capital plan. So let's talk about where we are today. At the end of Q1, we ended the quarter with $482 million of corporate cash. That's cash available at the parent company to fund stock buybacks or any other capital transaction. Q2, we are expecting a dividend of $85 million from the bank, $102 million from our broker-dealers, bringing our corporate cash position to $654 million. Now, I do want to caution, while the bank dividend is recurring and funded out of earnings, the broker-dealers includes a one-time dividend really from our clearer right-sizing the capital balance to today's environment. About 80-some-odd million of it is going to be, $75 million of it is going to be that, and the remainder is going to be an ongoing earnings dividend from our securities broker-dealer. So you can see that we've got plenty of corporate cash to be able to continually fund the buyback program, and that's coming up from the earnings of our subsidiaries and will continue to give us a lot of flexibility in how we run our business. When we look at bank capital, we ended the quarter at 8.6%. The dividend value is about 0.3% of capital. Capital available to fund the balance sheet then to our target state of 49.5 is an additional 0.3, giving us a level of 8%, which is where we intend to operate the bank. Now, we did talk a little bit about on our last earnings call about what our intention is going forward. We think if current trends remain intact, we will be able to get to a level of 7.5% Tier 1 leverage at the bank, and we hope to get to that level sometime in the early part of next year. If we are successful in achieving that, we will free up an additional $170 million of capital from the bank and be able to move that to the parent. So focusing on some capital actions that we've already taken, I talked a little bit about what we achieved in debt when I previewed the capital timeline. This lays it out in complete detail. If we go back to 2011, we had 10.2% coupon debt on a face of $1.6 billion held at the parent. Through successive deleveraging and paydowns of that debt, we've gotten ourselves to a place of a target state of $1 billion of debt at 5%. So we've more than cut the cost in half. We've cut the coupon in half. We've cut the amount by a third, and we've extended the maturity by 2 years, massively de-risking the company. This was recently recognized last year by both Moody's and S&P, moving the company to an investment-grade debt rating. On the balance sheet side, what we were able to do, our excess capital position put us in a position of being able to take out that expensive liabilities that I talked about earlier. And you can see here what we did. We took off $4.5 billion of liabilities at a cost of 329 basis points, and we replaced them with off-balance sheet customer funds at a cost of 2 basis points, greatly transforming the earnings profile of the company and driving the performance of our balance sheet higher. So what are the capital actions that we have going on today? Well, there are two capital actions that are currently in progress. One, we are focused on growing our balance sheet to the target state of $49.5 billion. That's going to involve, from the end of Q1, moving an additional $1.6 billion of deposits onto our balance sheet, and we are making steady progress on that, and we should complete this in the first half of this year. Additionally, we would have $2.1 billion of deposits, which we hold at third-party banks, that could come onto our balance sheet would take our balance sheet to 51.6. Now, that's about as inefficient as a place that you can be under the current U.S. regulatory environment, and so we're going to pause at 49.5 while we study what we have to take on in terms of becoming a SIFI under the current U.S. regulation. And in the meantime, that hope, you know, continue to grow that 2.1 as we grow our customer business. At some point in the future, the pool of deposits off balance sheet should be big enough to bring back on and meaningfully offset the costs involved in the regulatory costs involved in breaking 50, and should therefore be able to drive pretty significant value to our owners. On the other side is really what we've been doing in the buyback program. Our board authorized an $800 million buyback program last year. We are more than halfway there at $454 million completed, and we intend to continue going. As I've showed before, we have the capital available to do it coming from earnings generation, and we'll continue to make progress here as we move capital up to the parent company. I don't want to dwell in the past too much, but I do want to show the power of some of what we've been able to achieve. I talked a little bit before about what we've done in corporate interest. So starting on the bottom part of the slide, we have taken corporate interest and cut it by more than two-thirds. If you go back to 2011, provision expense was $441 million. It is now a benefit of $79 million in the last 12 months. Loan servicing expense has declined by more than 50%, and FDIC expense is down roughly 70% in total. All of that is factored in to significant growth in adjusted pre-tax income, bringing us to an adjusted pre-tax income number of $635 million over the last 12 months. What's not shown here is the capital initiatives that we talked about before in terms of the transformation of the balance sheet and the elimination of our wholesale funding and having the capital strength to do so. The last page I want to leave you with is a really an updated version of our long-term earnings slide. What we have here, if you start in the leftmost column, is really our a summary-level income statement over the last 12 months. What we then layer on to that is many of the initiatives that we've talked about. So first, growing our balance sheet to $49.5 billion at our guidance range for NIM of 265 gives us a material increase in net interest income. We apply our targeted operating margin, which is improving from the last 12 months to a target of 37. We fully adjust the share count. So this is not where we are today. This is when we fully affect the $800 million repurchase authorization, where we're getting to at a current price of $24.14 when we created the slide, gives us a significant improvement in overall share count, which gives us pro forma EPS of $1.68. This is not guidance. This is to say this is the impact of all of the initiatives that are going on now in terms of the company, in terms of what that generates from an income statement perspective. The next column over answers a question that I know many investors have had for quite some time is, what is the sensitivity of interest rates to your balance sheet? Now, we did not give that out for a long time because it didn't make a lot of sense because we were doing landscape changes to the balance sheet, such as the wholesale funding trade that I alluded to earlier, or presented earlier. Looking at the next column is really the sensitivity of our income statement to a 100 basis point parallel move. We pick 100 basis points parallel because it's an easy shock for everyone to understand how we're moving the curve. But we do have sensitivity really to all points. We're asset sensitive across all dimensions from short rates all the way out to intermediate term rates. If you look at what that does, it's roughly a $200 million increase in net interest income and about a $42 million increase in non-interest income. The non-interest income is coming from fees we earn on off-balance sheet deposits. That gives us pretty considerable expansion. We believe that a lot of that expansion will flow directly through and not generate much of an increase in cost, so our operating margin should improve to about 43% under that scenario, giving us considerable earnings leverage. The last column really looks at what a 5% growth of our key customer activity would do. And it's best really to understand that column if you look to the middle section of the bottom of the slide where it talks about customer activity. If we grow trading activity by 5%, it's worth about $25 million in revenue. If you look at growing margin is broken out there. customer cash, as well as fee-based products. And because we layer on the growth assumption post the interest rate hike, we break out the value pre and post in the slide so that you can see the value of it if the interest rate increase did not occur. So pretty significant operating leverage to a small level of growth in the core business. So what I want to leave you with is we have consistently been at the forefront of digital innovation. We have a business model that is well positioned to continually generate capital and to allow us to take advantage of the transition in the direct brokerage space. We believe that we have a significant opportunity to improve wallet share and grow significantly in the retirement and investment space. And we believe that we have more opportunity to continue monetizing the value of our corporate services area, generating substantial growth from that channel. Thank you very much.
Hi, can I ask about the DOL reform on retail savings products and the incentive structures for financial advisors in the U.S.? What are the threats and opportunities for your business?
Sure. For us, as I noted in the presentation, we have about $50 billion of retirement assets. Much of that falls in the category of fully self-directed, so it falls outside the DOL rule. Where the rule really impacts us is around our managed product offering, our managed investment portfolios, and UMA accounts. We will have a significant amount of work, but not enough that we've broken it out in terms of cost, around coming into compliance. We plan to absorb that work really in our existing sort of legal and compliance area, and we don't see much incremental out of resource, although it will be a significant focus to come in compliance over the next year. So we have not really calculated a cost to break out that we see as significant enough to isolate really just related to that rule. I think that's different for a lot of our competitors, where retirement-based businesses and the incentive structures have been very different and will require a lot more work to come into a line. Given the position we're in, where we're not selling proprietary asset management products, we are not selling the higher margin products such as annuities or private REITs or things like that that have been positioned into retirement accounts. There's very little cost outside of the direct compliance cost of updating disclosures and account forms to come into compliance, and that's what we're going to be working on in that area over the next year. We do think over time it will accelerate the movement into the direct space for smaller accounts. So we do think that there is going to be a benefit or an opportunity set, you know, coming out of the evolution of the rule, because the larger firms are going to just push even further up in the value chain in terms of sizing, giving firms that are digitally centric the better than have products that are compliant but profitable at a smaller size range a better opportunity. But at this point, there's nothing we can really quantify. That's just more qualitatively how we think things will evolve.
Threshold for smaller accounts?
Well, we look at our accounts and we have designed our portfolio optimizers and how we're looking at profitability to be profitable all the way down to $25,000. And so, you know, while certainly we would like larger accounts to grow assets more meaningfully, you know, we believe that there is value to be generated at all sizes in our company. We know other larger firms are putting a much more focus on accounts of greatly multiples of that size. So, you know, for us, it's about delivering on value at all customer size levels.
And then, sorry, just a last follow-up. So, in the UK, similar reforms led to the disintermediation of a quarter to a third of financial advisors. Do you see something similar happening in the US?
Well, keep in mind, we don't service any registered investment advisors. Some of our larger competitors have big RIA channel businesses or independent brokerage channel businesses where they custody a lot of those assets. So the risk to us is more around coming into compliance with the rule and some of the long-term litigation that exposes. As far as what's really going to happen in the industry and the divestment of small advisors, we don't really have a good view into that because we're really not in that space. We don't operate an RIA channel.
Hi, thank you. Just on the robo-advisor side, you continue to make investments in your core product offering there. But will future additions come from internal build or some M&A? I know that Betterment and Wealthfront are making inroads into this, and I wondered whether.
Yeah, in the area of robo advisors, you know, we've had a product of, you know, available to our customers that's been very similar to a robo advisor going on about 6 years now. You know, it follows through from a risk tolerance questionnaire to a mapping of portfolios. And we've made it available with a single commission to buy the recommended portfolio. What we're doing now is we're looking at the product set that's out there. We're looking at the evolution of what's a best-in-class robo-advisory. And I think to get to the point of your question, I think it's something that we would focus more on building than buying. These products are very, you know, we don't see anything proprietary. We see things that we can build in quite a competitive way. And we'll be back later with a new and improved product.
Okay.